Hi, I'm Robin Daly. This is the Esther Life Show, where I get out and about to find out for you what's going on behind the scenes in the world of cancer. This week's show is a leap from the last one in that I'm privileged to be able to talk to a courageously candid and open woman about her personal situation and her extraordinary story. So today I'm in Kent and I've come to meet Sophie Savage at her home in glorious Kent. And Sophie came to my attention a little while ago when I was sent a link to her blog, which I found an extraordinary post she put up called My Beautiful Brain. Last autumn, she had what was in itself a pretty difficult diagnosis to deal with. She was faced with tumours in her lung, her lymph nodes, in her neck, her spine, her shoulder and her ribs. But on top of all that, she had a concern that something else was going on. She started having vision problems. She felt that some of her thinking faculties were impaired somewhat. And she pushed to have a brain scan done. But she found that she was completely unprepared for what came after that. And all of this happened 5 months ago, and now she's in what many people would call a very extraordinary situation, sitting here at home calmly, drinking a cup of herb tea and looking very well. And hence I've come down here to talk to her and to find out a bit about what's happened to her, what she feels contributed to what looks on the face of it like a bit of a miracle. So anyway, good morning, Sophie.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for welcoming me into your home.
You're welcome.
And so your website has got a title of My Journey of Wellness with Terminal Illness, which is a bit of a provocative title. I'd like to come back to that later, but perhaps you'd just like to start telling us simply about your diagnosis, the prognosis, everything that kind of led to you stepping outside of conventional methods as well.
Okay, so I was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer on October the 13th, 2014. I had almost no signs of it before I was diagnosed. I had a very sharp pain in my back one morning that lasted about an hour. I took a Nurofen, it went away. That was the only symptom I had. But I just knew something was really, really wrong. So I went to see my doctor, who thought I had some kind of chest infection or virus, gave me antibiotics even though there wasn't a virus in my blood. And then I just started pushing and pushing to be x-rayed and scanned. So eventually it all unfolded. And on October the 13th, they found multiple tumours in my lung, my right lung. Then they found tumours in my lymph nodes. Then they found them in my bones and finally in my brain. So the whole diagnostic process took about 3 weeks. And it was
a roller coaster.
It was a devastating 3 weeks. Mm. And there began my journey in and towards wellness.
Right. Okay, well, one thing just to throw in there is kind of well done for pushing as hard as you clearly did to get all your diagnostics, because we hear so many stories, people are contacting Esther Life who've been a bit worried about things but have been given and told, oh, it's probably only this or it's probably only that, and then 6-9 months later, when they're in a terrible state, enraged about the lack of diagnosis at the time, quite understandably. Yeah, maybe you want to speak a bit more about the actual. Obviously, you'd already faced this very serious diagnosis with all your organs and your bones, but there was something in particular about the diagnosis of the tumours in your brain that inspired this particular post that I read, and your whole relationship to that, and yeah, what decisions you made following that.
Well, I mean, my prognosis was very poor. They didn't give me a date, but once I made it past the new year, one of my doctors said he didn't think I would make the new year. So, and I got into very, I mean, I was, even though I had no symptoms at that time, within days of the scans, I was in considerable pain. I was coughing blood. I was breathless walking up the stairs. It's interesting. I swear the scans themselves kicked it or stimulated all the tumours, because there's radiation in the scan. So after the PET scan, I was in instant pain, and I was in no pain before that. So, you know, I was in very deep trouble in November. The life force was leaving my body daily. And the brain scan, I don't know, it was just my worst day. They, there was something about that news that was worse for me than the original diagnosis. And partly because I was expecting maybe a tumour behind my left eye or something. I knew there was something going on. But they said I had multiple tumours in the lining of my brain and in the tissue of my brain. So, too many to count. I said, how many? And they said, too many to count. That was the... I remember them saying that. That was the mega shock for me. It was too many to count. And they wanted to radiate my whole brain. So, I mean, I've worked in the field of human development, personal development, psychology for 20 years. I teach people how to create clarity of mind, how to work through their fear, how to see clearly, think clearly, relate to life with clarity. And suddenly my brain was under threat. And I was feeling it. I mean, I was mixing up my words. I was, when I was texting people, I couldn't spell right. My left vision went. So it was, that was a terrifying day for me, because I thought, I can do this if I've got my, my mind. But to do this journey without my mind. And I spoke to quite a few people who've had brain radiation, and they often say I'm not the same person. So to me, it seemed like my identity was being threatened and my state of mind. And I'm confident to face most things if I've got a clear state of mind. So I think that's why that was the most daunting day for me. And I resisted the radiation hard. I still haven't had it to this day. I wanted to look at every option I could look at before I had my brain fried, really.
Fair enough. Yeah, well, that's interesting, because, of course, I mean, I assume that anybody would have a similar sense of their identity being threatened by something like tumours in their brain. But it's sort of particularly... applies to you maybe in much the same way as anybody who's threatening to have their fingers taken off would find that terrible, but a pianist would find it devastating.
Exactly.
So, yeah. So, okay, you resisted the radiotherapy. You didn't resist all orthodox treatment, though, so
no.
Maybe say a bit about the kind of treatment you have.
So,
for the
I mean, I give all credit to the orthodox treatment I have had, as well as the complementary, and... I think my probably one of the blessings on this whole journey was I was diagnosed with a particular genetic mutation. So I have a genetic mutation that they're now developing different drugs for. So there's a form of chemo drug. I don't even know if it's really chemotherapy. They're called tumour inhibitors that I've been taking for this particular mutation. That targets your, it targets my tumours, it shrinks my tumours. And some people have a very strong response to that, some people don't. I believe I've had a very strong response to that.
Okay.
And initially they wanted to combine the tumour inhibitor drug with brain radiation. They wanted to start them at the same time. And I asked if they could wait and see if the drug penetrated my brain before we radiated my brain. So they agreed to do that because this drug apparently does penetrate the brain, which not many drugs can do. So I did that. I've been on that drug for 4 or 5 months now, and I've had, I think, a very strong response to it. It's called afatinib. I had a very severe reaction to it at first. It fried my mucous membranes, so my face looked like a pizza.
Yeah,
it was blistered and acneed, and all the mucous membranes in my mouth and throat dissolved, so I couldn't even swallow water. So we had to renegotiate the dosage. I was on the highest dose, I'm now on the lowest dose, and I'm responding to that fine. I get, you know, nosebleeds and a few things like that, but it's completely manageable. But I've been doing that, but I've also, I mean, I've been doing many other things I can tell you about, but one of the things I did at that time was contact an amazing doctor in Germany called Dr. Dana Flavin, who I saw on a film called Cancer Conquest. And she, I could probably cry talking about her, actually. She runs a non-profit research organization called ColMed, and she's been working with cancer patients for 37 years. She integrates synthetic and natural medicine. And I contacted her and said, can you stop them frying my brain? And she said, yes, I can. Take Boswellia serrata and berberine every day, 800 milligrams of each, three times a day. That will help your brain. And she's written articles about, she's worked with women with breast cancer and helped them get rid of brain metastases just using these herbs. So I started taking those immediately, and I do think the combination of all the other things I'm doing, but in terms of my brain, I think her treatment and the conventional treatment made a big difference. So my last brain scan, I was clear of brain tumours. No metastases were detected, which even my oncologist, I mean, they're funny, because everyone likes to take the credit. So I have a lot of practitioners. Well, Dr. Flavin didn't take the credit, but most practitioners like to take the credit. And I don't really care where the credit goes. But my oncologist at my last meeting, he's a lovely man. And I said, what did you think about my results? And he said, well, he said, the radiologist has done a lot of scans like this, and he's never seen anything. And then he stopped himself finishing the sentence, and then he said, well, it was a profoundly good result, Mrs. Savage. He didn't really want to finish the sentence. I mean, I think he was trying to tell me the radiologist had not seen the like, because my brain was cleared in 4 months. So I think it's a combination of things I've been doing, and I would think a bit of help from God on high at the same time. I don't know how it happened, but right now I have no tumours in my brain.
Extraordinary result. Yeah, and your blog, you asked the question whether this is a miracle, and you say you think it's probably not a miracle, but close to it.
Close to it for me.
Yes, certainly for you, yes.
I have a five-year-old daughter, and it's close to a miracle for me.
Yeah, well, it certainly sounds like it. Yeah, so you basically put the brakes on the whole brain radiotherapy, and at this point that looks like it was a good choice. And as you say, I mean, you've pointed to two particular things you're doing, one orthodox, one not, which you think are both big contributors to it. But you also alluded to the fact that actually that's not all you've done. So maybe you want to talk a bit about the rounder picture of what you've done.
Sure, that's quite a long answer, I'll give you the long
answer. Start in where you like, and let's see where we go.
So the first thing I did the day I got my diagnosis was change my diet. I just intuitively knew to do that.
Okay.
Even though conventional doctors do not believe in what I'm doing. They say, eat normal food, eat a balanced diet. It kind of blows my mind when I go to the oncology unit and there are bowls of sweets sitting next to the IV drips. Because they're not actually trained in nutrition, doctors in the UK. Whereas if you see any nutritionist, first thing they'll do is they'll tell you to change your diet. So I became wheat-free, gluten-free, dairy-free, caffeine-free, alcohol-free, meat-free, sugar-free, all at once. I just quit the lot.
That's a big change.
All at once. It was a radical change.
So that left you with, what were you eating?
I'm pretty much vegan. I eat organic chicken sometimes, and I eat wild fish.
Mm-hmm.
And I eat any vegetables, and I do juicing and things like that. And I'm learning to cook very different meals.
Mm.
But before I took any treatment at all, any of my orthodox drug or anything else, I stopped coughing blood in 6 weeks, and I became able to breathe again. So I think the diet had quite a radical effect on me before I started any other treatment.
Mm.
I don't have any other evidence than my own. Mm. It's just my personal experience. But everyone I've spoken to has said diet is very important.
Mm.
So I've done that. I take many, many supplements.
Just
sure.
To finish on the diet,
sure.
We'll move on. So were your dietary choices a result of your own investigations, or was this actual advice given to you personally?
Bit of both. So I did a lot of research. So when I was diagnosed, I spent probably 3 hours a day researching everything I could possibly research about everything to do with cancer, because I'd been told that was on the way out, really.
Mm.
But I also met with 2 nutritionists and a naturopath, all of whom advised me the same things.
That's good. You got a consistent picture from them.
I got a very good... And also the Oasis of Hope Hospital in Mexico, where I go, they have a very particular diet that they've designed for people
with
cancer.
We'll talk about them more a bit later.
So
okay,
I've had the same advice from everyone I've spoken to.
Well, that is heartening in itself, because you couldn't have said that 10 years ago.
Mm.
You're likely to get nutritionists contradicting each other violently. And
there are variables. Some say do ketogenic, some say do vegan.
Mm.
You know, some say do raw, some say do cooked. So that you need to figure out your own path with
it.
Really.
You felt that it was largely within a spectrum that was consistent.
Enough consistency for me to be confident.
Well, that's important, isn't it? Because it does gives you the feeling that everybody's homing in on the same truths about diet.
I think so.
Yeah, excellent. All right, so...
Except the conventional medicine world.
Okay.
Who tell me to eat sugar. Meat and
yes.
things like that.
Yes. Okay, so... So let's move on. That you were just mentioning, okay, you take supplements, so... Without going into, I take this supplement, I take that supplement.
No, I won't list them. Very boring.
That's a bit dull in a way, but it's personal to you, obviously, as well. But maybe you're thinking behind the supplementation, what kind of supplements you're taking, why you're taking them, how you decided.
Sure. Again, I got advice from several people. I was completely naive about all this before I was diagnosed. So I spoke to nutritionists. I got advice from Dr. Flavin. I'll tell you more about Mexico. I got advice from them, all of whom have prescribed me different supplements for different things. I think one key area has been, I have this wonderful naturopath called Mr. Lee. He's Chinese, he's in his 70s, and he's extraordinary. And I'm a big fan of Chinese medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And he spent a lot of time diagnosing my medical history, and he said to me that he thinks the root of my cancer lies in my colon. So I have no cancer in my colon, but he said I'd been severely dehydrated in my colon for 30 years, and he picked up a lot of parasites and bacteria in my colon and fungus. Too much coffee and tea down the years, I'm told, and not enough water, so let that be a lesson. And he's been trying to get my colon right, because then the detox pathways are open. If the colon's working, then I can detox and I can get everything else working. So I've spent a lot of time taking supplements and various drops he gives me for the bacteria and parasites in my colon.
Hmm.
I'd say my it's a bit embarrassing to have met this on radio, but... My colon and my bowels are healthier than they've ever been in 30 years.
Okay.
And I think that's had a lot to do with me getting weller. So my diet and addressing my colon has been really important.
So you attribute those as being important factors.
And then there have been other supplements I take for my lungs, for my bones, I mean, things like citrus pectin are good for bones. So I've been told different things are good for different... I take about 60 a day. It's not fun.
No. Yeah, it's quite a marathon, but not so unusual in the world of a complementary and alternative medicine with cancer.
The challenge is integrating them and working out how do they interact with each other.
Exactly, yeah.
And again, Dr. Flavin's really helped me with that. So she does research, she looked at all my supplements for me and said, you don't need to take that, you do need that, don't put those two together. So I was really lucky to find her.
I think that's a very good point you're making there. I mean, in Britain, we have no such thing as integrative medicine, really.
No.
It doesn't exist.
It's annoying.
The two sides won't talk to each other.
I know.
And so what can we do? We have to do it yourself.
Yeah.
In fact, you have to be in the middle and you have to talk to each of them separately and try and make it up. But
and it's really stressful, doing
it's that. Very stressful indeed, because, of course, you know that the two sides are not talking to each other and they quite often think very badly about each other and their advice as well. But nonetheless, that's what we have to do. And it leaves the person with cancer in a position where they're almost having to be an expert for themselves, you know, which they do become experts on themselves. I'm sure you're one by now. And experts on their own condition. But things like this, sort of the interaction of various different strands of a treatment, is a very complex issue indeed.
It's very complex.
And you can't really expect people to be able to find that information for themselves even. So to have somebody who's on your team, who's on your side, wants you to stay alive, who is non-judgmental about what you're doing, but only interested in whether it's going to help you or not, who will then be able to tell you, oh yes, well, if you're going to do radiotherapy, you want to hold off doing that till later. Whatever it is, that kind of information is gold dust, really, because otherwise you could be investing time and money in things that are actually contraindicated and not helping you. You're actually detracting from the treatment, or even worse, you could actually be, you know, making matters worse.
Yeah.
So I think that's a very important element, particularly in this country.
You need to be very intelligent about it.
You do. You have to be pragmatic and intelligent and get the help you need, because, let's face it, it's not a simple territory. This one is unbelievably complex, and it only gets more complex as the years go on. And some really good expertise. You can't beat it, can you?
You can't beat it, and you also need people to encourage you, because I find it's a very, very scary situation to be in.
Yes.
So when you have different doctors telling you that what you're doing is wrong or dangerous or won't help you, and yet you've got someone else saying it will, that's a very difficult position to be in, and you need to, in a way, trust yourself more than anyone else.
Mm.
And yet, I'm not the expert, I'm not the medical expert. So I've found it very stressful being told off for what I'm doing, rather than have someone say, well, tell me all about it and let me see if it's contraindicated. And I mean, this is why Dr. Flavin's been so brilliant, because she'll collaborate with anyone. She just cares about the patient and she understands both sides of the medical treatment. So,
yes.
But on the whole, it's even the complementary practitioners tell me off for doing the chemo drug.
Yeah.
And I find that it's quite a kind of psychological battering to be in the middle of that sometimes.
Absolutely right. I think, we've got a very strong stand at Yes to Life, which is up to the people themselves what they want to do, and it's our job to support them in doing it, whatever that is. So integrative medicine, if it's going to be anything real, means that they're going to turn to whatever's going to be helpful to them.
Exactly.
And it doesn't matter whether it's called orthodox or alternative or anything else. Is it going to help is the only question, and the answer to that has to be, that has to be answered by the patient themselves, ultimately, and they need support in that. So, there's a book came out about a year ago called Radical Remission. I don't know if you've
read it.
Great book. Don't you think?
Well, my husband read it in detail.
Did he?
And gave me the high. I skim read it because I've read so many books.
Yeah.
But I have read it.
It is an unusual one, anyway, in amongst all the books out there by Kelly Turner. And she, the result of a piece of research into what the things, the sort of top things that people did that helped them to have an extraordinary result, basically, to in situation where they should have died very quickly. And the thing that you just alluded to, which is basically trust your intuition, trust yourself, was one of them well up there, you know.
Yeah.
And it does, yeah, it does require that, really, that to navigate this extraordinarily difficult path with these very strong forces at work trying to drag you this way and that, that you're able to actually tread your own line and to find out which is the right way for you and be strong with it. And, yeah, people deserve to be supported in that, but they don't always get it, unfortunately. And some people have had to go it alone against their family, their friends, their medical team, all sorts of people to do the thing that they thought was right. And that's amazingly difficult when you're facing an existential situation.
I think you need to direct your own treatment, but that takes... I think it takes great self-confidence, and I think it takes an attitude of I don't know, determination, clarity. I mean, you're like a deer in headlights when you've got this disease, and when all those forces are telling you to go this way or go that way or go the other, and scaring you while they're telling you it, it's just very easy to go along with what you're being told to do, and you can become obedient instead of really looking at, is this really the right thing for me to do? I mean, many people don't even get second opinions just because they've been scared, almost scared to death.
Yeah.
And I see it just in the waiting rooms in hospital. You can feel the fear in the room. And I mean, I remember sitting in the waiting room waiting for the radiation on my neck. I had a tumour on my C3 vertebra that was eating into my spinal column, so I was in a lot of pain, and I did agree to have radiation on my spine. And I remember sitting there, and there were tears just rolling down my face one day because someone had sent me a very loving text that made me cry. And the Macmillan nurse came running up to me like I was about to kill myself or something. Are you okay? Are you okay? She was very concerned and sweet. But the tears were rolling, and she said, "Are you all right? Are you all right?" And I looked at her and I said, "You know, I think I'm maybe one of the few people in this waiting room who really is all right. You know, because I'm the only one crying. Why is no one crying? You know, and why is no one else being vulnerable? Everyone's numb. Just you could feel them numbed out. And it's part of the system, I think. It's a kind of numbing out that happens. And then if you're not feeling and you're not alert and aware and alive to what's going on in your own body, it's very hard to make your own choices in the midst of so many pressures.
That's an extremely good point of actually allowing yourself to feel the process you're going through in order to know whether you're going the right way or not. Very important.
But there I was, the only one doing it. They thought I was depressed, and I was I was kind of the opposite of depressed,
Well, emotion doesn't go down that well in hospitals, does it?
No.
Let's face it.
No.
I remember a friend of mine who I took in, they scraped him off the road, they took him to hospital after being knocked off his motorbike, and when I arrived there, a junior doctor was just berating him for having a bit of a cry about it. And I could not believe it, but
This stuff happens.
All right, so let's just go back again. We were talking a bit, we were talking about, you talked about diet, about supplements, a little bit about Chinese herbs. What, anything else in there?
Yeah, I do Chinese herbs, I do acupuncture.
Tell me why you do acupuncture.
I've done acupuncture for years for various things, and it's always been very effective for me. I mean, I had my daughter through IVF, and I found it very difficult to recover physically from IVF. I couldn't lose weight, my thyroid wasn't working. No one told me what IVF did to the body until afterwards. And I saw an acupuncturist, and everything started working within weeks. Similar when I was pregnant, I had difficulties, I had acupuncture, and it's always worked for me.
So what have you looked for acupuncture to contribute to your situation overall this time?
I have it every couple of weeks, and he just takes my pulses and checks what's going on, and sometimes my kidneys are struggling or my liver's needs detoxing, or he just works out what I need each week and sticks needles in me. I don't know what he does. It's like maintenance. But he also gives me herbs. So he gave me Chinese herbs that stop the spread of metastases, for example. Now, how that works, I don't know, but I told him it was spreading, and he said he concocts these herbs that slow or prevent the spread. So I can't give you any evidence that that's working, but I haven't had any spread.
But, it's not done any harm.
It hasn't done me any harm, and I reckon what doesn't harm me, I can do.
Okay.
And then I've also been to clinics in Mexico.
Yes, so let's talk a bit about the Oasis of Hope. I've been there.
Have you?
I have, just to have a look, yeah. So, amazing place. So, yeah.
There's two clinics I go to in Mexico. Okay. One is the Oasis of Hope, and one is called the San Diego Clinic. Mm-hmm. The Oasis of Hope has been going for 50 years. I think if you probably look them up in Wikipedia, they'd be slated as quacks and weirdos.
Probably, yeah.
Probably, but anyone who's trying to help cancer patients that isn't in the pharma industry guidelines seems to get easily berated. But I think they know what they're doing. They've been going for 50 years. They have some very good statistics, especially with lung cancer and prostate cancer. They do integrative therapy, so they combine radiotherapy, surgery. They do low-dose chemotherapy, so they do the conventional stuff, but they integrate it with diet.
Yeah.
They do... when I go there, I haven't had any chemo or anything there. But what they do is they build your immune system so it's very, very strong. So if they're going to give you chemo, they'll build your immune system way up, and then they'll give you low-dose chemo. So they're quite clever about how they do it. So they get your immune system as strong as they can get it. So when I go there, I've been there twice, and I've had mega doses of vitamin C.
Mm-hmm.
I've had mega doses of Lyotril, which is B17, which is very controversial. It's illegal
always
in some countries.
Yeah.
It's done me no harm. I've had mega doses, and I'm still here. They swear by it in Mexico.
Yeah.
Interestingly, in Mexico, the law there is that they can offer any treatment that's been approved by any country in the world, which is why there are such good cancer clinics in Mexico, because they can offer so many different treatments, whereas here you can't get these treatments. So I have hypothermia there, which is when they heat your body up to about 40 degrees. For 3 hours, it's intense. They sedate you about 38. When you hit fever pitch, they knock you out. But this is very common practice in Germany. They've been doing it for 30 years. Switzerland, 30 years. You can't get it in the UK, bizarrely. But tumours hate heat. They love the cold and they hate the heat. So tumours shrink in heat. So this is a very standard practice at these clinics, and there's no side effects. You can get slightly dehydrated, but I always get them to give me fluids beforehand, because it's like you've run a marathon. You sweat that much, and you turn into a lobster. It's not a pretty sight.
No.
So they do that there, and they do something called ozone therapy, where they take your blood out and oxygenate it and then put it back in, because tumours hate oxygen. They thrive in acidity. They love sugar. They love the cold, and they love minimal oxygen. This is all, I think, very well researched. I think it would be poo-pooed by most oncologists in this country, but I think it's making a difference to me. Then there's another doctor. There's another clinic called the San Diego Clinic, which. So Oasis is run by Dr. Contreras, who's magical. He's charismatic. He's like a priest and a doctor all rolled into one. I mean, the doctors, they treat you and then they pray with you, which I just find really refreshing, because they know their limits. You know, they go, you know, we're not the only ones who can heal you. I mean, they're a bit holier than thou, which is a bit much for me, but I kind of like the spirit of it, if not necessarily the practice of it. And then there's this other doctor at the San Diego Clinic called Dr. Munoz, who was also on this film I saw. And he's a very, very humble man, and he's developed vaccines. So he takes your cancer cells and vaccinates you with your own tumour.
Mm-hmm.
If that isn't quite cool. I don't know if that's really cool.
Yeah.
There's something called a dendritic vaccine. Yes. A lot of them are still being trialled,
mm-hmm.
but I'm willing to be a guinea pig.
Okay. So you're going to, particularly for that one treatment, in addition to what you're doing at the Oasis.
And it's worth saying, I have needed to raise a lot of money to do this. So
yes.
I could not have afforded this. The treatment I get in the UK, I don't have to pay for, but... the treatment I get abroad is expensive. So I've done fundraising and people have been incredibly generous. And, you know, anyone out there who wants to do these treatments, you'll be amazed what people will give. I haven't put a page on my blog yet, but I might at some point. So far I've just done some friends and family. I also work for an educational charity for 20 years and...
Mm.
I've made a difference to a few people, so they decided to help me out. So that's what's made it possible, has been fundraising.
Well, that's a good opportunity for maybe me to say a little bit about that whole aspect of things. I mean, it's not quite on the main topic of cancer and its treatment, but it's a very important topic about when it comes to access to treatment. And, a lot of people who... approach Yes to Life. Obviously, they may know exactly what they want to do, but they haven't got the resources to do it. Or they may not. They may need to find out the whole, work out exactly what on earth to do. But at the end of the day, there's an issue of money, because all of these treatments that we've been talking about, they're all of them private medicine.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you say they're very expensive, but just to be clear, they're expensive... for a single person on looking at their own budget, as compared with a lot of orthodox treatments, they're not actually.
No, they're cheap.
They're actually relatively cheap. Most of them, some of them very cheap indeed. And so, but nonetheless, we're not used to shelling out for this stuff. We're not getting it paid out of insurance or anything like that, so we have to find the money. But what you've done there in raising the money amongst people you know, I feel it's quite an important ingredient of the journey for a lot of people.
Yeah.
We actually do this for people. We have what are called personal fundraising schemes. We actually help them to fundraise amongst their friends and colleagues. And many people are very reluctant to do it. It's kind of age dependent. The older they are, the more reluctant they are usually. Young people are much more into sort of tossing everything out onto the internet and seeing what happens. But older people are generally more used to being private, and that they would be unwilling quite often to ask for help even. Mm. But if we can persuade them to do it, people are often extremely surprised by what happens in terms of, first of all, getting the cash in a surprise kind of way, but secondly, getting an incredible level of support, often from unexpected quarters coming their way, which actually affects them psychologically quite deeply, because...
Yeah.
As you all know, the whole journey of cancer is an isolating one, essentially. It puts you in a place where you feel like the only other people who really understand what you're going through are people who've been through it. And this whole process of goodwill and money, usually with nice messages attached, coming towards a person, is extraordinarily strengthening and encouraging. And it's a kind of, you know... form of social medicine, which is fantastic in a way, there, where people are saying, well, look, you know, they're not telling people what they have to do, they're saying, look, here's the resources, you go do it because we like you and we want you to be well. And that's an amazing thing to happen. I love it. I think it's one of the best things that we do, you know. I really love doing that. So people, I think when people are out looking for what to do, they shouldn't allow the limitations of the money to get straight in the way before they discard things and say, I'll never be able to do that, I could never go to Mexico, I could never... whatever it is. And so, because there are ways, and it does happen.
Well, for me, I mean, I would say I'd have been very proud about asking for help before this. And I'd say one of the many gifts of having cancer, and I think I've had many gifts from having this disease, is I had to get over that really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And quite early on, you know, I saw people's awkwardness with
me.
And even people I felt very close to just stepped back, didn't know what to do, didn't know what to say, didn't know how to speak to me, wanted to help but didn't know how.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked all that up very quickly, and at first felt quite hurt about it, and then I realised that actually they just didn't know what to do. And I remember writing an email to many of my friends and family saying, I think I understand what's going on, so I'm writing to you to tell you what I need. This is what's going to help me, and this is what doesn't help me. I did a list for them about what's helpful and what's not helpful.
Yeah.
And it was quite a funny list, and it was quite a kind of tear-jerking list. And some of it was practical, some of it was emotional. You know, I said, no sympathy, empathy is good, no sympathy, please. You know, come and cook for me, come and do this for me. And so many of them were so relieved.
Yeah.
And they just said, thank you so much for telling us what to do. I didn't know what to do.
Mm.
And before I knew it, I had a team of... I even asked them, I said, would you form a support team for me and figure out how to do all these things for me?
Mm.
And within a few weeks, I had a support team just rallying around.
That's what people need.
And I tell you, I think it was a life-saving move because people were showing up with organic food, filling my freezer, driving me places, you know, because I was too ill to do that, and giving me money and various other things.
Yeah.
You need to ask, but when you do, it's humbling, but it's also very healing because you really find out how loved you really are.
Mm. Yes, it's a kind of key, that asking, that unlocks just enormous possibilities of relating to people in new ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's very important, the piece you said about, I mean, I said what it does for the person who's got cancer, but of course it does an amazing amount for everybody else as well, because not only they get the benefit of knowing exactly what to do when they're feeling like terribly uncomfortable, as you say, and they just don't know how they can possibly help. I'm not an oncologist, so I can't help. That sort of feeling. And it's nothing to do with that, of course. But if you tell them, then they're very happy about it. But... you know, they're going to step in. They become part of your team, and furthermore, they all. I mean, you know, let's face it. Everybody, somewhere in the back of their mind, there's got this thing about cancer. With the statistics coming up to 1 in 2, the idea that I might get cancer, you can hardly ignore it. But we all try to. We all try to live as though we don't want to know anything about it until the day we have to, and that's how we meet cancer, completely blank sheet, like, I have no idea, you know.
Yeah.
Lots of people don't even know what chemotherapy means.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, what you offer in a way by being prepared to ask for help is that you are, you're kind of breaking the scary barrier for all those people ahead of time. They haven't got cancer yet, but they're actually finding out what it's like for you, and they're seeing that, oh, she's actually not just going along doing all these things, she's been quite resourceful, isn't she, and doing all these other things. I wonder why. And so the whole picture's being opened up for people. Maybe 50 people or more, in your case, you know, are having this, you as an example of what's possible, and you've come up with a small miracle already.
It's one of the reasons I wrote, I started my blog as well, because we need to talk about this stuff.
We do.
And even though it was a very vulnerable thing to do, to put my journey online, which scared my mother a good deal, but she's come around, we need to talk about it. We need to talk about our fear of it and fear of dying. And, I mean, some people just couldn't engage with me about it. I just think that it just puts your mortality to you when you meet someone with terminal cancer.
That's the reason people can't talk.
There's so much fear of it. And if we're not talking about it, then I think the fear contributes to the dying. I really do.
Right, I would agree with that, yes.
Yeah, so there was a... You,
it's half the battle.
On that subject, you quoted your teacher, a nice quote which I could definitely relate to, having been to the bottom and found it was firm.
Yes.
Which, you know, it's part of the journey in a way, and, you know, many people have been to the bottom for a lot of different reasons, but the bottom can so often be a life-changing point in your life when you get there and it's firm, which means that you're not dead, actually, but you're still alive, and you faced all your worst fears. It does open the doors for another kind of life that you didn't have before when you were in total fear of ever going to the bottom. And so, you know, maybe you want to say a little bit more about that, because obviously it had this kind of effect on you.
It really has, actually. I mean, I'm not through the chute by any means. I still have cancer in my lung and bones. But I would describe it as the most transformational experience I've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
The paradox for me is I call my blog My Journey of Wellness with Terminal Illness because yes. I feel psychologically and spiritually weller than I've ever felt, and actually physically right now weller than I've ever felt. So I'm gravely ill, and yet,
what a paradox,
I'm weller than I've ever been, partly because I've been on this journey of discovering what it means to be healthy, but also I've been on a journey of finding out how much my life means to me, what I have to live for, what I really want to be doing with it. I mean, I've been doing things I've always wanted to do.
Excellent.
But, I mean, I wanted to be a writer when I was 12 years old, and I set it aside. And suddenly I'm writing again and going, oh, I remember I wanted to do this when I was 12, and I never did it.
Well, you're clearly quite a writer.
So I'm loving things like that, and I find myself more joyous than I've ever been. I've always been a bit of a glasses half empty girl. I work in personal development, so I've worked a lot with people who suffer in their lives and have, you know, helped them find their self confidence or their leadership. I used to run big change programs in businesses, and I find myself laughing more. I have more joy. I have more. I have a much better sense of humor. I'm more present to every day. I just appreciate every moment I have, and it's been amazing. It's been an amazing experience for me, and I feel more awake, more alive than I've ever felt.
Excellent.
And I'm still terminally ill.
Well, this is the stuff that, of course, people strive for in their life and find it very elusive. So it's interesting that.
I'm blessed because I've spent my life teaching people how to choose their attitudes. And I mean, my teacher's teacher was Viktor Frankl. And Viktor Frankl said, "The last of the human freedoms is to choose your own attitude in any given situation, to choose your own way." And that's an easy thing to say, but my teacher, Brad Brown, he developed a whole methodology for helping people do exactly that. So I've been teaching people to choose their attitude to whatever life gives them. So I love the name of your charity, Yes to Life. I found it so ironic when you contacted me, because we have T-shirts in the program I train in called Yes to Life, saying yes to life on the T-shirt. Because what we do is help people get their yes to whatever life sends them, however hard it is, which usually involves getting the no first.
Yeah.
And moving through the fear and through the resistance and through all of that. There's no way around it. You have to go through it. But people get dealt really tough stuff in life.
They do.
And so to have taught people that for 20 years and practiced it with other things that have happened in my life, this was the toughest. And
of course,
it was the hardest shift in attitude I've ever made. It took me, I would say, 2 full months to go from, no, this is terrible, dire, awful, terrifying, shouldn't be happening to me, to this is happening to me.
Yeah.
It is happening to me, and I choose it, and I accept it, and I surrender to it in a way. And then the creativity comes.
Fantastic.
It just gets unleashed, but it's not a simple thing to do that.
No.
And I hope my blog will be a way to help people do that. I'm wanting to write more now about how do you shift your attitude, how do you get through the fear. And I haven't been writing about that so much so far. I've been more sharing my own experience.
That's so important. It's so important.
You know, I hope to move in that direction with it.
Excellent. All right, well, I hope everybody will be looking at your blog. It's just under your name, sophiebabbage.com.
Savage.
Savage.
Like cabbage, but with an S.
I've said that before. Yeah, new name. I haven't come across it before. Okay, so that's great. Ask you one last thing. It's very disparate, the things you've done about your situation, ranging from radiation to re-examining your relationship to life. I mean, a huge range of things there. What do you think are the conclusions you've come to about the nature of illness and cancer in specifically? That, you know, during this whole investigation that have led you to do all these different things, what's your overall take on cancer?
It's a really good
question.
Either
its mechanisms or its origins or its, you know, any of this.
Okay, so one of the things I struggle with I think an attitude to cancer where you read about it, you see posters about the fight against cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that quite difficult to align with, because I think treating it as the enemy and fighting against it is part of the problem in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a me against it conflict inside you that I think creates stress. Whereas it's inside me, the thing that I'm fighting against is inside me. So unless I take it by its hand and ask what it's going to teach me, then I'm not, that's easier for me than fighting against it. That's a kind of attitude, I think. And I think it's been teaching me a lot. And if I let it teach me, then I have a chance of pushing it away. I'm not assuming that, because that's a very long road for me, and I'm told against the odds that would happen, but I'm aiming for it.
Excellent.
I can tell you that.
Yeah. We go for the extraordinary.
So I think in a way we need to learn a lot from it instead of railing against it. And I think I'm discovering it's more of a symptom than a disease. So we treat cancer as a disease, and yet we don't go to the underlying causes of how come I got this in the first place. Those are the questions the doctors don't look at. They treat, it's cut it, burn it, slash it. So you treat the symptom, but unless you're in an inquiry about how come I got this in the first place, and that's not an easy inquiry because there isn't an obvious cause. Some people smoke and never get cancer. Some people smoke and get cancer. Some people eat unhealthily all their lives and never get cancer. Some people eat...
It's not straightforward,
you know, it's just
it?
Not straightforward. No. But for each individual, I think you can track the contributory factors of your own disease. Dis-ease. It's a dis-ease in your body. It's a dis-ease in your psyche. It's a dis-ease in your spirit. And I think the factors are environmental, physical, psychological, and spiritual. And I'm in therapy as well as I have treatments. I found myself an amazing therapist because I want to get to the bottom of it in, you know, what are the shocks in my life and the traumas in my life that may have played a part in me having this disease, as much as what have the behaviours been like eating badly, or, you know, I had eating disorders in my teens, and I have no doubt that that was a major contributing factor to me having cancer later on. So I've spent quite a bit of time trying to track the roots of it, and I think it would help if we could all do that instead of treating the symptom, which is tumours, which obviously need treating. But unless we get underneath it, we are going to head towards one and two. And we live in a society now where our diet and the environment we live in, it's undeniable that, I mean, it's almost a pandemic or epidemic, I don't really know which is the right word, where one in two people, 1 in 2.5 now, are getting diagnosed with cancer. We need to look at what's contributing to that. And so for me, it's a symptom rather than a disease, but it's a dis-ease in the human body and in the human spirit. And I think as long as I relate to it that way, then I can hopefully stay here a bit longer.
Well, you're doing an impressive job so far.
Thank you.
Okay, so we'll wrap it up there. I've really enjoyed our talk. Fascinating, really, really very interesting. And yours is such an extraordinary story. And I love the way you've thought about it so deeply as well. It really contributes to what you have to say about it now. So thank you very much indeed.
You're really welcome. Thank you for coming to see me.
That's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed it enough to want to come back for more next week. Anything that was mentioned during the programme, such as websites or books, you can always find on the Yes to Life website. Simply go to yestolife.org.uk and follow the links to the radio. If you want to send us any feedback, we'd love to hear from you. Any ideas for the show, please email us radio@yestolife.org.uk. Goodbye.